If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In today's episode, you will hear from the journalists Peter Snow and Anne McMillan, who are the co-authors of a new book, Treasures of World History, The Story of Civilization in 50 Documents. The husband and wife team caught up with our digital editorial assistant, Rachel Dinning, a little while back to discuss some of the remarkable items and documents featured in the book.
So your new book, Treasures of World History, reproduces 50 incredible artifacts and documents that tell us the story of civilization. It's a broad sweep across 4,000 years of history and all five continents. So firstly, what was the thinking behind this book? Why did you want to produce it?
Well, we just got an incredible feeling that the one thing missing in the world was a good textual and illustrated volume that would tell people what the really huge monuments to human endeavour and achievement are. These are documents. The other thing about documents, they're alive. They're there. They really are living memories of great events in history. So we just wanted to do that. And we had great fun, of course. I mean, we selected about 200 documents first. And we had great arguments. I mean, Anne won most of the arguments.
Yeah, how difficult was it narrowing it down from, you said you had 200 artifacts and documents originally. How difficult was it to narrow it down to 50?
Well, we tried to cover a number of different aspects. We wanted to be geographically, we wanted it to cover the world. We also wanted to cover the arts and politics and women's liberation and all sorts of different subjects, science. So it became pretty clear early on which were the great documents in each of these particular disciplines.
And we wanted to spread it around the world. I mean, we've got actually about half the documents that we've chosen are European, and the other half are from most of the world, right the way from New Zealand across Asia, China, India, to America and Canada. So we've got a good spread. They are world treasures.
And in your introduction, you point out that many of these documents, if not all of them, have changed the world in some way. Perhaps could you both give us one example of an item or document that has changed the world significantly? What's the perhaps most notable example of this for you both?
I would say probably the most important document is perhaps the Declaration of Independence, the US Declaration of Independence, which was an extraordinary moment in history when a few colonies, we all thought, well, you know, how tiresome they are, these chaps over in America complaining about the tea tax, they declared that they were going to go independent. Of course, they created the most extraordinary country, which has become the most dominant, the most prominent country in the world. And I think that was probably the biggest landmark moment when history changed. I got lots of other ones I could mention, but Anne, come on.
Well, I was very fond, as you might expect, of the New Zealand suffrage petition of 1893. Now, this was when New Zealand, like many other countries in Western Europe and Britain, of course, and in North America, women were trying to make a point that they deserved to have the vote. And in New Zealand, it was a particularly active group. And I just love the sort of details of this. For example, had it not been for the invention of the female bicycle in the mid-1800s, this petition would never have happened, because the fact that women were able to ride a bicycle that was comfortable meant that women in New Zealand, suffragettes, could bicycle all over the countryside gathering signatures on this enormous petition. In all, they had something like 32,000 women sign this petition. If you look at the petition itself, which is huge, it's 885 feet long. It's lots of pages, 546 pages all joined together with all these signatures on. And some of them are terribly well written, sort of very intellectual women. And then you just have X's from people who were not able to write. Anyway, the New Zealand government was divided into two houses, and the lower house passed this this bill saying that women should have the vote in 1893. And during the debate, this huge petition was rolled out on the floor of the Parliament building. But then it went to the upper house of the New Zealand Parliament, which was a lot more conservative. And there was a huge fight. And it became known as the Battle of the Buttonholes, because the men, all of them were men, obviously, in Parliament, who supported the suffrage bill wore white camellias, and the opponents wore red camellias, and there was an enormous fight, and eventually it just passed by two votes, and so women got the vote. And then 10 weeks later, there was an election in New Zealand, and something like 80% of the eligible women over 21, voted, and the newspapers had predicted terrible trouble with drunken louts attacking these women who were going to the polling booths. But in fact, one newspaper said it resembled a gay garden party, with pretty dresses of the ladies and their smiling faces lighting up the polling booths. And of course, New Zealand became the first self-governing country to give women the vote. British women had to wait 35 years before they were allowed to vote. American women had to wait 25 years. So I thought that was a really important document.
Of course, of course. And many of the items featured in the book were discovered as well by complete chance. So we've got like the suffrage bills and the Declaration of Independence, which ended up being legislation and things. But some of the documents were discovered by chance. So for example, the Rosetta Stone, someone just simply came across it and thought, oh, this looks important. What perhaps is the best example of this?
I think one has to mention the greatest archaeological discovery of all time, which is the Tutankhamun, 1922, when Howard Carter went to that tomb. And he looked through this little chink of light from he poked his torch through a hole in the tomb, in Tutankhamun's tomb, and he saw inside the most extraordinary treasure house of things that had ever been seen before, as you say. And one of them was this extraordinary chalice, this lovely little cup, on which was inscribed this little message to Tutankhamun from the people who designed the chalice. And it was absolutely a lovely little message, which said that, you know, the artist hoped that he would have happiness for millions of years in the new life that he's about to engage on. And that's 3,500 years ago. It's the most wonderful document there. It's writing on a cup. I think that's lovely. But there are lots of other examples. You mentioned the Rosetta Stone, the hundreds of other documents like that.
Well, there's Hammurabi's Code, which I'm fascinated by. It's the very earliest document in our book, 4,000 years old. And it was a wonderful stelae, a big black rock, upon which were written 282 laws dictated by King Hammurabi, who was a Babylonian warrior. And it disappeared. And nobody had seen it for centuries. And suddenly, French archaeologists were digging in Iran, and they discovered in 1901 three broken stones with funny writing all over it. And it turned out that this was Hammurabi's code. And the code is really interesting because there are lots of laws that have to do with property and business and family. But the code also lists lots of punishments. And one of them is, for example, if a son hit his father, the son's hand would be cut off. And then there's also incest between a mother and son leads to both being burnt to death. However, a father who commits incest is simply banished from the country. Also, another great thing about this is that it's the first sign that people were innocent until proved guilty. Hammurabi insisted that when somebody was charged with a crime, people came and bore witness, and then somebody decided whether or not that person was guilty. So fascinating.
And that's nearly 4,000 years ago. And I mean, you know, lots of other documents are like that. I mean, you know, one obvious example is the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, the incredible stuff that they dug out of a cave. And by sheer chance, this shepherd goes into a cave and says, "Hey, what's that?" And it's these incredible pieces of history stuck away in pots in this cave by the Dead Sea.
And a more modern example is Anne Frank's diary, because, as you know, when she and her family went into hiding in Amsterdam in 1942, she kept a very detailed diary of what it was like living in this very enclosed space hidden away. And when the Gestapo raided their hiding place in 1944, they took all valuables. They took all the Frank's furniture or anything valuable, but they left Anne's diary and papers that she'd been writing on scattered all over the floor. And someone who'd been looking after the Franks and protecting them went to the apartment after the raid and found these papers lying all over the floor. Anne Frank and her sister and her mother all died in concentration camp, but her father survived. And when he got back to Amsterdam, this wonderful woman who had saved the papers came and gave them to him. And the rest is history.
One wonderful example, I think, of documents that could have been lost is the Book of Kells. I mean, there were these chaps, these monks on the island of Iona, 800 AD, 1,200 years ago, and they were copying the Gospels onto this wonderful manuscript of the Book of Kells itself. And along came the Danes, and they started wrecking everything left, right and centre. And so a few of these monks grabbed the book, jumped into a boat and whipped across to Ireland. And mercifully, this thing was then hidden away in the Kells Abbey for, you know, 1,000 years. And it's popped up now in the Trinity College Library. We had to see it in the Trinity College Library in Dublin. It's fascinating and beautifully done. I mean, one could talk about it for ages. But the lovely thing about this book is the illustrations. I mean, the pictures of all these documents and pictures of the associated stories about the documents. There's a wonderful picture of one of the pages of the Book of Kells with Jesus' mother, Mary, sitting there in a chair. I mean, the humour of these monks, that the baby Jesus looks like an old man. And the theory is that the monks, these artistic monks who were scribbling these things, writing it beautifully and drawing it beautifully, is that one of the monks thought, I'm going to use old brother Geoffrey or someone to be my model for the baby Jesus, and so on. It's fascinating, all these little stories.
I love that. So some of the documents and artifacts featured in the book will be probably instantly recognisable to readers. So, you know, we've got things like Magna Carta, we've got the Declaration of Independence, the Diary of Anne Frank, which we mentioned. Can you perhaps tell us about some documents that are less well-known, but maybe should be household names?
One wonderful cynical example is the little bit of paper. The scene is autumn 1944, and Winston Churchill is sitting at a table with Joe Stalin, and they're sitting around this table, and they're talking about the future of Europe after 1945 victory, which is about to come. They all know it's going to be victory eventually, not quite sure when. And so Churchill scribbles down on a piece of paper what he thinks Russia and the West should do about countries like Romania, Bulgaria, and Greece. And Churchill scribbles down, just literally, he puts down Greece, 90% us and 10% you, meaning the Russians. And then Romania, you know, 50%, 50%, whatever it is. He scribbles down what how the West and Russia should share these countries. Unbelievable cynical stuff. And Churchill himself wrote in Stalin gave a little tick because he rather approved of all this. In fact, Churchill ended up with far less than he asked for. But the lovely thing about this is that Churchill wrote in his war memoirs afterwards, but wasn't this a bit naughty of us to be exchanging this naughty letter, he called it.
But didn't Stalin also say, I suppose you want to destroy this piece of paper? And yeah. Churchill said, no, I'm going to keep it.
That's right. Stalin said, I think you want to burn this thing. And Churchill said, no, history, dear boy. So, I mean, you know, it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I was actually looking at that one just this morning, and just the sheer brevity of it, and how it's almost like a shopping list. It's like go get the milk, go get the apples. It's so short, and it's got such massive significance.
Massive, and one country he left off, Churchill, for example, is Poland. He left Poland off, and of course, to his huge discredit, really, because he should have said, because the Poles were known to be likely to want independent and free democracy.
And they
didn't get it.
But also Polish pilots had fought with the RAF.
And Polish pilots had fought so bravely with the RAF and so on. And wasn't included in Churchill's offer, as it were, which he pushed across the table.
I'm sure all football fans will know about this document, but I didn't until I wrote about it. The football rules of 1863. And it's called a Football Association Minute Book. Is the document that we chose. And it's just it's a book, really nondescript looking little book, that is full of notes about meetings that took place to try to standardize the rules of football. Because in the 1800s, there was a real push to try to make one set of rules for football, because each team that played had different rules to play by. And so the final sort of meetings to decide this took place at a tavern in London called the Freemasons Tavern in October 1863. And 12 men from different football clubs around London all sat down, including the leader of them, a man called Ebenezer Morley, who came from Barnes, where we live. And actually, we walk past his gravestone on Barnes Common every time we go for a walk. So it's, again, didn't know about this man, but here he is in our life.
You don't meet many people called Ebenezer these days.
But anyway, in the end, they came up with 13 rules. And one of the groups in the discussion called from Blackheath Football Club was against he wanted a couple of more extra rules, including running with the ball and also something called hacking, which means you can kick your opponents. And the other 11 said, no, we don't want any roughhouse. So Mr. Blackheath Football Club representative walked out of the meeting and started his own club. And he started the Rugby Football Union.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed, use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
A few years ago, a librarian in France was going through a pile of English books and found a first folio, one of the original folios. And most recently, in 2016... Mount Stuart House in Scotland. Remember, it was completely renovated. And they found a first folio there. So more of those may still appear, which is very exciting.
Mm. Do you think with the advent of the internet and the ability to view any of these documents or items, you know, you can Google a lot of them and see pictures, we've lost a bit of the magic of actually going and seeing them in person and getting that real, you know, the real impact of seeing it in its physical presence. Do you think that that's a problem, or is it also helping opening up history to a much wider audience?
I think it's wonderful. It's opening up history. We certainly use the internet to look at these pictures ourselves and get related information. It was really wonderful. But we also went and looked at a lot of the ones we could look at, nearby documents. And there is something so magical about seeing the original. As Peter said, the Rosetta Stone, for example, at the British Museum is beautiful. And as Peter said, the Book of Kells in Dublin are just, there's nothing like looking at the original handwriting of these monks so many years ago. You don't get that feeling on the internet, but I think the internet plays an incredibly important role in making people interested in these subjects. And hopefully if they read about these things in our book, they will make an effort if they're in Paris to go and look at Hammurabi's stele at the Louvre, or if they're, you know, in the US, they'll go and look at the US Declaration of Independence. I really hope that will inspire people.
But talking of the Rosetta, I mean, one of the most, in fact, I challenge your listeners to go and have a look. When you go to the British Museum, look at the Rosetta Stone. It's terribly difficult to see, but if you look on the Rosetta Stone, which you can only really see if you see it actually in itself at the museum, at the top is the hieroglyphic, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, which were then translated by all these wonderful, brilliant chaps, British and French, Champollion, and so on into French and English. When you look at the bottom line of the hieroglyphics at the top of the stone, you'll see few little hieroglyphics with a cartouche around them, a little oval line around them, and that's the name of Ptolemy the Fifth, to whom this stone was written. And that's absolutely fascinating, very exciting. All this sort of thing is so exciting when you see the actual document. You're quite right; it's not quite the same on the internet. Of course, it's very valuable having the internet.
Yeah, especially more than ever. Obviously, when at the moment, a lot of people stuck in their houses and not able to get out as much. So I've been doing a lot of those virtual exhibitions recently. I was also just thinking, the Mona Lisa, it's not something mentioned in your book, although you do have Leonardo da Vinci's codices. I remember, because I'd obviously seen the Mona Lisa in print and online so many times, and the moment when I actually saw it in real life, I was like, my goodness, this is such a small painting. I had like this vision of this huge sort of 2 meter canvas, and I saw it in real life and it was tiny, and I had to stand really far back because there was a huge crowd in front of me, and it was quite it was a great moment because it'd been something I'd wanted to see for so long, but it was also quite interesting how the reality matched up to the sort of idea in my head.
Well, talking about Leonardo, I mean, his notebooks are fascinating. You can see them very easily online. The Louvre, for example, has put one of their books of codices completely online, and they're fascinating to look at. But to actually go to the Buckingham Palace, the Royal Collection exhibition, it was just extraordinary to see his delicate little drawings and his weird writing, because he wrote something called mirror writing, which is from left to right. They're not quite sure why, but experts think that probably because he was left-handed. He was extraordinary because, as well as doing the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper, those things that we really know all about from Leonardo, he also was an absolutely nonstop note taker. He used to walk around with little bits of paper in his pocket, and he'd take them out every time he had a thought. He'd take it and scroll it down, or if he saw something interesting, he'd write it down. And for example, the Mona Lisa has that extraordinary smile. And if you look at Leonardo's codices, if you look at his writings, you see that he studies the mouth and the smile. And that's presumably he used his studies of the mouth and the smile to actually paint Mona Lisa. But I was just fascinated by him. And again, when you talk about missing documents, I think something like 20% of the hundreds and thousands of bits of paper that Leonardo jotted his thoughts and drawings on have been found, and they're all in museums except for one, and guess where that is? Bill Gates owns it. And he uses some of the pictures that Leonardo drew in his particular, the papers that have been assembled into Bill Gates's book. He uses them as screensavers on his Microsoft products. Mm. But I just love Leonardo because he is one of those guys who is just, he was so fascinated by everything. And in fact, because he was so interested in making notes and drawing war machines and drawing human bodies, he was one of the first people to ever draw a baby in utero, in a baby in the mother's stomach. He also was the first to define arteriosclerosis and cirrhosis of the liver. He was just fascinating. And that's why he didn't do many paintings, because he was so busy in all his other projects that his painting suffered.
And it's those paintings that we perhaps know him best for. And that, you know, people should actually go out and look at this other side to him as well. The sort of the scientific curiosity. So I was wondering, we've covered quite a few documents already, and I asked you which document you think had the biggest impact on history. But I was wondering if you could both maybe take me through three documents, your three top documents that we haven't discussed already. Sorry, that's putting you a bit on the spot.
The lovely thing about this book, by the way, is that the documents are very clearly printed on one side of the page. And then you have another page full of wonderful pictures of the people who published the documents and the statues or whatever that's associated with them. I mean, it's really a picture book as much as an explainer of what the documents are all about. Anyway, yes, I mean, for example, great fun, the Beatles. I mean, Anne knows much more about this because she studied it in great detail. But it was Brian Epstein, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who scribbled down on a piece of paper. Was it a cigarette packet?
No, it was a letter.
A letter. He scribbled
down on an envelope.
He scribbled down the back of an envelope his plan for the Beatles' tour of America, which he sort of dreamed of. When the Beatles weren't just being discovered, 63?
Well, the tour was in 64.
He did it in 63 for the tour in 64. It was his dream of where the Beatles would like to go, in sort of Philadelphia, you know, Maple, and all this sort of stuff. And that's a wonderful document. It's a piece of paper on which something is written that changed history. That tour of the States the Beatles did was fantastic.
In the summer of 64, they staged 32 concerts in 33 days right across the United States and Canada. It was extraordinary.
Another wonderful example is a thing that I discovered, which is a map drawn by an extraordinary chap, an astronomer in Hawaii, of what he thought the universe actually looked like. And he...
This is 21st century. This is our most modern document.
This is the most modern document we've got. And I had a chat with the guy, and he said, yes, very exciting. Of course, I cannot be absolutely sure of where this particular galaxy is or that particular group of galaxies. They have these, what they call these clusters of galaxies. And within each galaxy, you have billions of stars. I mean, we, on the Earth, on our little planet, we're one of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And the nearest galaxy to us is the Andromeda galaxy, which is 6 trillion miles away. Sorry, correction. It's two and a half times that. It's 2.5 light years. That's 1 light year. It's actually 22 trillion miles away, this Andromeda galaxy. And that is the nearest one of the billions of galaxies in the universe. And this wonderful map sort of shows you, gives you some idea of what it's like. That's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful document, that.
One that's very dear to my heart because I'm Canadian is the British North America Act of 1867, which created the country of Canada. And I found it in the parliamentary archives at the Palace of Westminster, and it's tucked away between the Metropolitan Poor Act and the Dog Licenses Act. And it's a long scroll, neatly rolled up, with a red ribbon around it. And it created the country where I grew up and am still a citizen of. So that was very exciting for me.
Wonderful. And talking of science, I mean, one wonderful scientific moment was when that wonderful chap everybody worships, Brunel, the great engineer, the British engineer, who built the Great Britain in 1840. And the thing you will notice, as if you didn't notice already, about the Great Britain, it has a propeller, not a paddle. In those days, paddles were the things you tended to put on the side of ships to get them moving. But we got this letter, this one of our documents, is the letter Brunel wrote when he realized that actually the paddle wheel he was going to put on the side of Great Britain was a mistake, because there'd just been a test of a ship called the Archimedes, which is run with a propeller, and it was doing 2 knots faster, 2 miles an hour faster than a paddle wheel boat. And so he said, right, everybody, change ships, change engines. I'm going to scrap the thing we've got in Great Britain at the moment, the paddle wheel plan, and I'm going to put a propeller in her. He put the propeller in, a huge cost, and the thing went at 11 knots and not 9 knots, as he was planning. Tremendous moment in scientific history. We've got this marvellous letter that tells you when he suddenly realised.
Shall we tell Rachel about our Einstein problem?
Oh, go on. Yes.
Ooh, love to hear about your Einstein problem.
In case you wondered if we did this totally peacefully between us doing these subjects, there was one moment of crisis. I chose to do Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, I have no scientific background. I read English at university, but I'm very curious and I love finding facts. So I thought I could do this. So I found it was really, really difficult. It's a very, very complicated scientific concept. And I did a lot of research. I did more research for Einstein than I did for anything else. I spent weeks trying to figure out exactly what the theory of relativity was. And finally, I thought I'd cracked it. So I wrote away and I got my 800 words and I handed them to Peter, very proud of myself. There was a long silence as he read it. And then he turned to me and said, I don't understand a single word.
True.
That's amazing.
We decided to send it to someone who actually knows about Einstein's theory of relativity, a physicist who had got a first from Oxford. And I waited, shaking in my chair, for his reply. And I was so pleased when it came, because he said, for someone who hasn't studied physics, this is a most admirable attempt.
Very good.
So Peter had to eat his words.
I struggled to understand it. I got there in the end.
Were there any you said it was incredibly difficult narrowing down your choices for the book. Were there any, and we've spoken a little bit about documents that are perhaps missing from history. So what documents almost were included but didn't quite make the final cut that might be worth a little shout out just now?
Oh, my goodness me, yes. Well,
we only have one author, Shakespeare, in our book, Shakespeare's First Folio, which is a fascinating story. But I will let you read the book and find out about that. But we did think about maybe including, you know, a German writer or a French writer, Balzac or something, but we decided probably one writer was enough. So, and Shakespeare is so universal that we opted for him. And in science too, I mean, we've done DNA, we've done Einstein, we've done Copernicus, we've done Brunel, but there are just so many, and we've done the World Wide Web, but there are so many fascinating scientific discoveries that we just wanted to include but just didn't have the space.
Then of course we were determined to include something that brings all the arts we've included, but we particularly wanted to include a bit of music. So we thought, well, now what on earth are we going to put down? What score shall we slot in here that describes a huge moment in musical history? Of course, you don't have to look very far. But the first bar of Beethoven's Fifth, ba-ba-ba-bum, it's a terrific moment. V for victory, of course, after that. All the implications of that has conjured up of how it was used in the Second World War and so on.
That was one I read this morning as well. And there was so much I didn't know about. I've heard that piece of music so many times in films, on TV. I didn't know any of the context of it. The context of what was going on at the time with Napoleon. And yeah, it was really fascinating. So this is a piece of music that I'm so familiar with, but I don't know the context behind it at all. And that was really, really interesting to learn about for me.
But one thing that tickled us was we thought, my goodness, the Apollo 11, the trip to the moon, we've got to choose something, some document that sets in historical context the wonder of that extraordinary moment. I mean, you know, here we are 50 years later, we still haven't got to the moon again. Anyway, so we thought, well, what are we going to do? And we looked very hard at all the documentary
it
evidence.
It was really boring, the actual official
yes,
report.
Yes, right, the long statement summary of what happened. And then we discovered one little picture, which was a graphic of the heartbeat of Armstrong's heartbeat as he brought the lunar lander down onto the moon's surface. And that heartbeat, which is normally, what, about 60, 70, whatever your mind is normally, it's about 60 or 70 most of the time, it went up to 140 just a few seconds before he touched down. And we thought, that's the That's the document
that says
we need.
It all.
That says it all.
Yeah, that's telling a story in itself, isn't it? Women in the book. So we've spoken a little bit about suffrage. What other remarkable documents do we have related to some remarkable women in history?
Well, we have Mary Wollstonecraft, who in the 18th century wrote a book called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. And this was the first time any serious person had written a book which argued that females were rational beings and they were entitled to be treated in the same way as men. Now, this, of course, caused an absolute sort of scandal, not least because she had rather a scandalous life, which you will read about. But she was great. She said, you know, she was determined that females should take control of their lives through education, that men should stop treating them like some sort of what she called toys or spaniels in a gilt cage. And she argued very, very succinctly in this book that men and women are equal in the eyes of God, so they should be subject to the same moral code. So this was a really important book. The trouble was that she was rather a rather odd woman in those days because she had affairs. She had an illegitimate child. She tried to commit suicide. She had a very, very, very interesting private life, which nowadays would probably be celebrated, but then was looked down on. Mm-hmm. And she eventually did get married, even though she didn't believe in marriage. And she had a baby called Mary, and she died shortly after the baby was born. After she died, her husband wrote a no-hold-bars book about her and talked about the abortion and the affairs and the suicide attempts. And she was then, her memory was absolutely, you know, what a terrible woman. We will not read this book, even though the book at the time had been reasonably well received. So it basically, nobody read it for about 100 years. And it wasn't until women started campaigning to get the vote in the 1900s, about 100 years after poor old Mary had died, that her book once again was taken seriously. So she really, in a way, is the mother of feminism.
Before we exhaust all of the items and documents in your book, perhaps both of you, do you want to just pick one final more document to tell our listeners about before we finish up the podcast today?
Well, yes, okay. I think people should turn to page 108 when they buy the book. They went about real excitement, particularly if they're American, because that is the page on which you will find the letter, not the letter, the poem in the handwriting of Francis Scott Key, where he writes down a poem. And people, very few Americans actually, I think, know this, that it was written, this poem, when Francis Scott Key was watching the British besieging Baltimore in 1814. And it's the British besiege of Baltimore that really prompted the writing of the American National Anthem. It's fascinating. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? And it was Francis Scott Key standing on the side of this boat with a bit of paper in his hand and a pencil, and he was describing his astonishment to see the American flag still flying over Fort McHenry, which the British had failed to suppress with their rockets and flares and bombs and goodness knows what they were firing at it. And Francis Scott Key saw this, and he wrote down the poem admiring the fact that the Star-Spangled Banner was still flying over this fort. And I think it's a wonderful moment. And that letter, written, just scribbled out on the back of a piece of paper. It wasn't the back of an envelope. It was a piece of paper he had in his pocket. And he wrote this out, and that's the American National Anthem. I think that's a wonderful moment.
Well, I would go to page 80 and look at Shakespeare's First Folio, because this is another fabulous story. It includes all of his 36 plays. Now, 18 of these plays would have been lost forever. Plays like Julius Caesar, Macbeth, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, had it not been for, after Shakespeare died in 1616, two of his former acting colleagues, John Heming and Henry Condell, decided they had to amass some sort of record of all of Shakespeare's work. 16 of his plays had already been published, so they put those in the book, and then they had to find some sort of copies of the other 16. And so they did that. They went around, they talked to other actors, they went through various notes, they went through stage directions, they went through all sorts of copies of his plays that he had written and left you know, with various people. They had to be very careful because there were an awful lot of pirated copies of Shakespeare's plays floating around, people who had been to his play and then written their own version of it and taken it off to have their acting company perform it. There was a great competition in those days. Anyway, they managed to do this. They got it printed. It took 2 years. It's, I forget how many pages. It's a great many number of pages, but it's all there. 900 pages, I think. It's all there. And these were published in wonderful book called A Folio. And nobody knows quite how many folios were actually published, but there is, we know now that there are about 235 in existence, and they're still being discovered. A few years ago, a librarian in France was going through a pile of English books and found a first folio, one of the original folios. And most recently, in 2016, Mount Stuart House in Scotland, remember, it was completely renovated, and they found a first folio there. So more of those may still appear, which is very exciting.
And that's quite an exciting prospect, that there are still many other treasures of the world that are out there yet to be discovered. And on that note, that is all we've got time for today. But so I just wanted to say thank you so much, Peter and Anne, for coming on our podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Nice to talk to you,
thank
Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel.
That was Peter Snow and Anne McMillan. Their book, Treasures of World History, The Story of Civilization in 50 Documents, was published on the 6th of August by Welbeck Publishing Group. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in again tomorrow for another lecture from our History Weekend events.